This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Boston wants 30 hotel rooms at the Quality Inn in Revere. They are for people currently in the area of Massachusetts Avenue and Melnea Cass Boulevard who are experiencing homelessness and addiction. The city of Boston says it wants to use the rooms for transitional housing and wraparound services for people at Mass and Cass. But Revere Mayor Brian Arrigo is against it, saying there has been no plan, and that makes the idea dangerous. Acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey and Mayor Arrigo are set to meet and talk out their differences later this afternoon. We caught up with Mayor Arrigo a little earlier today, and I asked why specifically he objected.
I wrote a letter to the Boston Public Health Commission expressing my immense frustration, and it's been more around the fact that there is no plan. You know, we've heard a lot about a regional plan. We've heard a lot about how we can potentially help these folks. We haven't seen any details. As I stated in the letter, I still don't even know how many rooms they're looking to rent from the Quality Inn in Revere. And so when we found out about this, which didn't happen the way these things normally happen, it happened through a voicemail. You know, there was some frustration, but ultimately, what we need to do is make sure that we're meeting the need of this humanitarian crisis. We cannot just move people in a bus and ship them to another city. We need to have a real regional plan, a responsible regional plan. This is a situation where all hands should be on deck. And that includes the governor, that includes the attorney general, that includes the DA, and includes Metro Boston mayors, multiple mayors in multiple cities. Coming together, convening, and figuring out how to roll up our sleeves and tackle this. It doesn't mean just moving people from one city to another, and that is what we've seen.
So a lot to unpack there. I'm going to pull some of the threads in what you just said, Mayor Arrigo, and I'm going to start kind of small. The city confirmed to WBUR that the pilot proposal is for 30 rooms. Did you get inconsistent numbers of rooms from the city, or did you just not know what the size was?
So we had heard everything from 160 to 30, and it depended on who we were talking to. We got different numbers,
and is 30 more attractive? Assuming.
Well, what we want to make sure is that there's an operational plan, right? We want to make sure that there are other regional partners that are part of this, that there are state stakeholders that are part of this, that this isn't just something where putting 30 beds in one place and that's it. What I haven't heard are who are the other partners that we'd be working with? What is the operational plan around that? And how do we make sure that we have the resources to be able to meet the needs of the folks that are going to be there?
So that's helpful. I'm going to pick that up for a second. Thanks. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No problem.
So you're really emphasizing sort of the coordination, the regional strategy, the planning. And so to clarify, you are not objecting in principle to housing people who are experiencing homelessness and addiction from the Mass and Cass area in Revere. You're not objecting to that. It's the process by which this is happening. Am I understanding you correctly?
Right. And that's from our own experiences. We spearheaded the COVID hotel that was at the Quality Inn, and that took leaders from the region coming together and working together. That took me working with my counterparts in other cities, mayors, city managers, and bringing people together, operationalizing how we're going to make this work, getting buy-in from everybody, and executing what was a well-orchestrated program of having a quarantine hotel at the Quality Inn. I have no confidence that the Boston Public Health Commission took any of those steps or can do any of those steps. And so what I look for is, again, to convene regional leaders, make sure that we have a responsible plan and that we have partners in recovery for a real plan. That is going to be the thing that allows us to meet this humanitarian crisis at Mass and Cass.
So based on that experience, and that seems like a relevant example of this kind of coordination, what are you worried will happen if people who have been experiencing homelessness and addiction at Mass and Cass go to the Quality Inn without that kind of regional coordination and planning? And I guess, Mayor, in the back of my mind is, is the crisis nature of this. It could take a long time to do what you're talking about doing there. You stood up the COVID hotel actually fairly quickly, is my memory.
Good.
Yeah. So,
right.
One, how do you think about the urgency piece in this? And two, what are you worried will happen if residents move into, short-term residents move into the Quality Inn with this, without this kind of regional coordination?
So I'm convinced if we have the right people around the right table who can make things happen, that this can be done in an urgent manner. And I know that I want to be part of that, right? And I know that folks all the way from the governor down to mayors and other communities are willing to roll up our sleeves and do this work. And I think it can be done in an urgent way. And we've seen that through the Quality Inn. It didn't take very long to pull that together, but it took time and effort and our teams getting together and working through all the logistics. If you don't do those logistics, ultimately, you have the consequences of that. And I cannot, as a mayor of the city of Revere, put my city in a place to potentially have the consequences of not doing this properly. There's a public safety issue. There are issues with the neighborhoods behind the hotel. There are a number of things that could happen that could go wrong if this isn't planned out and executed properly. And that's where the frustration comes from, is we know how to do this. I don't have the capacity to do this right now, but we're willing to help out and be partners. But that doesn't mean that just moving people from one place to another is not a regional plan and not a solution.
Mayor, and can you be specific about what you are concerned the consequences will be?
So everything that is associated with the hard-to-reach populations of homeless and the folks that suffer from substance use disorder, those issues are very real. We see them play out, and we're seeing them play out at Mass and Cass.
Have you and Mayor Janey spoken, Mayor Arrigo, since the letter?
We plan to speak this afternoon.
Okay, great. So in the meantime, the City of Boston gave us a short statement when we reached out. It said in part, quote, "The City of Boston must not shoulder this burden alone. Mayor Janey invites Mayor Arrigo and other mayors to join her in efforts to address the needs of those suffering from mental health challenges and substance use disorder in Boston, Revere, and across our Commonwealth. One such opportunity is a pilot effort in Revere that will provide transitional housing and wraparound services, helping some of our most vulnerable neighbors find stability, treatment, and recovery," end quote. What's the message? With that statement in mind, what's the message you want to deliver to Mayor Janey this afternoon, and what specifically do you want to hear from her?
So first, I do give her credit, because this is the first I've heard as mayor, and I've been mayor for 6 years now. This is the first time I've heard from any mayor of Boston or leader about working collaboratively on this specific issue. So I do give her credit and the willingness to be able to do that. And I'm happy to work towards responsible regional solutions. Mayor Janey knows that the challenges of Mass and Cass probably better than anyone. And it's in her neighborhood. And I will stand with her to work toward more buy-in from cities and towns throughout the region. It's not one community's burden to bear alone. It's not the City of Revere's. It's not City of Boston's. We have to be together and work together on that. And she's right about that. But it can't just be a displacement to another community either. And we need a real coalition. We need a real regional solution. And we need something that's responsible. And that's what I look forward to talking to Mayor Janey about today.
That was Revere Mayor Brian Arrigo. He is speaking with Acting Mayor Kim Janey of Boston a little later this afternoon. So let's get some more context on the situation unfolding at that area around Massachusetts Avenue and Melnia Cass Boulevard. WBUR's Deborah Becker was listening in on that conversation with Mayor Arrigo, joins us now. Deb, welcome back.
Thank you.
So I'm just going to start by asking you your reactions to what you just heard, Deb.
Well, I think he's got a point. If he did, in fact, learn of this through a voicemail and was not getting consistent information, then I think that Mayor Arrigo certainly has reason to have a lot of questions and a lot of concerns about this proposal. And comparing it to what happened in Revere for COVID and being able to set up some sort of emergency services on quick notice, he's right. He had partners. He had the state. And in this case, it doesn't seem to be the same. So I think his concerns are legitimate. At the same time, there are real problems in that neighborhood of Boston. And Boston has been trying for a long time to get other communities involved and to get help. And it hasn't happened at this point.
So Mayor Arrigo and I didn't discuss this, Deb, but the neighborhood around Massancast recently put a stop to a plan to house people at the vacant Best Western Roundhouse in the area, correct?
That's right. Victory Programs had a contract to use two floors of that hotel for up to 35 transitional housing beds, but neighbors didn't want it there, and they said other areas of the city and the state should be offering more of the services that draw people to the Massancast area of Boston.
So it is striking, Deb, same sort of size of intervention, right? 35 rooms there, 30 rooms in Revere. You know, it makes one wonder if there's an approach that is going to get a yes somewhere.
Well, that's a good question. I think there are probably a lot of communities that are reluctant to jump on board, worried that they may then have a similar crisis in their own neighborhoods without the proper infrastructure and resources. And I think that those are legitimate concerns.
So, Deb, we talked with you. I was looking at this. It was almost exactly a month ago after you spent some time in the area at Massancast. Conditions were deteriorating. So it's a month later. What is the situation on the ground like right now?
I think I would still say deteriorating. It continues to deteriorate. It's almost surreal. There are hundreds of people congregating on the streets, an estimated 200 tents at least on the streets where people are living inside those tents. Many people openly using drugs. There's a lot of garbage. Service providers are trying to keep people alive and find treatment beds. Business leaders say they're frustrated. They're improving security. The Greater Boston Food Bank recently said it had to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on increased security. And I spoke with Greater Boston Food Bank President and CEO Catherine D'Amato. She told me that in the past 2 months, the number of tents lining the streets around the food bank have spiked, and the trucks delivering and taking food have had a tough time getting around. This is what she said.
So there were no tents in our area in early August, and now they're on both sides of the street. And you, if you came down, you would see it. You would see people like in the street, around the street, you know, in and out of the street. There are Home Depot carts. There are grocery carts, there are tents, there are tents attached to our parking lot, there are, you know, again, needles everywhere, there's human waste, and there's a lot of garbage.
And D'Amato says that she and others in that area of the city are asking the mayor to require DPW crews to clean up the streets, which she says the crews are not doing right now. She also wants the mayor to require police to help clear people from the area so the trucks can get about safely. You know, service officials and city officials and state officials, they say they're going to work on this regional plan, but I think they really need to meet and to try to work hard to come up with a plan to address these issues.
And it is striking, Deb, I guess I'll just observe this. We're talking about the food bank, you know, an organization geared toward helping people who are experiencing a different humanitarian crisis, and it's becoming a non-starter for them as well. There is something striking about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the food bank feeds 600,000 people a month, and that is in jeopardy because of basic logistics, really.
So you've been reporting on these issues for years, Deb, and I guess I just want to sort of see inside your head, is this level of suffering more intense than what you've seen in the past?
Yeah, I mean, I think I did my first story about the area 5 years ago. So we've revisited it over the years, and I have never seen so many people in the Massancast area before. And again, I think it's going to take a large group, health leaders, business leaders, city officials, to work to try to address this and to deal with some of the problems there.
So, Deb, before we let you go, I know that you reported this morning on a different story, and this had to do with the new ombudsman for the State Department of Correction, the first ombudsman. That person has been placed on paid administrative leave. The ombudsman, Seth Peters, was placed on leave yesterday after being appointed to the post by the DOC and the UMass Chan Medical School. So can you tell us what's going on with that?
Yeah. Well, after we asked about Seth Peters' background, UMass said that he was placed on paid administrative leave and said it's investigating whether the ombudsman, Seth Peters, is the same Seth Peters who was involved in a wrongful death lawsuit that UMass settled 9 years ago. In that suit, Seth Peters, as an EMT, was accused of falsifying records about a man who was having a heart attack and who Peters and another EMT made walk down 3 flights of stairs. And the man later died. So there are concerns about the vetting of Seth Peters, if he is the same Seth Peters. And I spoke earlier today with State Representative Mary Keefe, who's co-chair of the Criminal Justice Reform Caucus. And she said she contacted UMass today to get more information because she wants this position appointed quickly. Let's listen.
We're generally looking for strong, independent oversight on lots of different levels of the DOC. To step out right now around this position and to have it to be so controversial is really not a good way to start.
So Keefe and the other caucus co-chair, Senator Jamie Eldridge, say they want the DOC and UMass to answer some questions about this and to get the process moving. The ombudsman is supposed to oversee COVID mitigation efforts in state prisons and efforts to reduce the number of people incarcerated in Massachusetts.
Deb, can you just stay on that part of this for us for a second? This is the first time somebody's even in this role. What led to this appointment, and how big of a deal is it to have somebody in this ombudsman role?
It's a big deal. This position was put into budget language at the end of last year. Senator and gubernatorial candidate Sonia Chang-Diaz wrote the language asking for this ombudsman to provide oversight to COVID mitigation efforts. What was happening in state prisons? How was the virus being controlled? What was needed in state prisons? How were deaths taken care of? How was health maintained? All of those things this person would do. The position was not filled by the end of the budget year, which was June, so it was renewed. And this person, Seth Peters, was just hired to fill the position, and a report about him was just sent to the legislature last week that he was taking over this office, that the office would be staffed, and this oversight would be provided to the Department of Correction, and it would be run jointly with the UMass Chan Medical School.
So in addition,
it is a big deal. Sorry.
No, that's okay. So in addition to watching the outcome on Peters, just briefly, what else are you going to pay attention to? What are you going to be watching for on this front?
I think it'll be interesting to see how quickly lawmakers can get someone in that position to oversee the Department of Correction and how this will all play out. I think that'll be an interesting story because there have been a lot of reports about the virus in state prisons and about other allegations of the mistreatment of prisoners in state correctional facilities. So I think it'll be interesting to see exactly how this story continues.
We will follow you as you follow along. That's WBUR's Deborah Becker. Deb, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
The new voice of heavy metal, a restaurateur who creates community through food, a creator of pop-up dance zones, a multimedia artist on a quest to bring wampum back to the New England landscape. These are just a few of this year's WBUR Artery 25, a collection of talented artists of color in the Boston area who are producing new and really engaging work. Arielle Gray, WBUR's arts engagement editor, joins us now to tell us about these fabulous 25. Arielle, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Tiziana, for having me.
So tell us what the Artery 25 is to start.
So a couple years ago, our team set out to highlight 25 creatives of color who were making big impacts on the arts and culture landscape here in Boston and beyond. And armed with a set of criteria, I guess you would say, we did choose 25 creatives of color, and they were our first Artery 25 cohort. So we do photo shoots, video, but beyond that, our reporters kind of do these really in-depth stories on what these artists and arts administrators are doing right now in the landscape of Boston.
I love this idea of thinking of them as creators. One of the things that struck me going through this list is there is art here, there's creation here, there's magic here for everyone, even if you're somebody who doesn't consider yourself an arts follower. So tell our listeners what they can engage with, you know, people who've been really for the last 18 months stuck at the kitchen table. What can they engage with here?
Oh, I don't even know where to start. I mean, we've got Tanasia Jones and Kadash Bennett and Pascal Florestal, who are creating new and exciting things for our theater, including, you know, just diversifying our stages, improving accessibility in our theater spaces. We've got music on the way from Oompa, who has an album, I believe, coming out in October. We've got new music from Red Shades, another rapper. There's just so much. I really encourage people to go through the list and get acquainted with these artists one by one, because if you've been craving art over these past 18 months, this list will definitely, definitely satiate that craving.
I'm sure there are many that you really find fantastic. I wonder, was there any moment as you were getting to know these artists and their work where somebody produced something, you saw a piece of work or heard something that just stopped you in your tracks?
I think the best part about this series is getting to meet and speak with all of these artists as we film them, as we photograph them. One of the artists who really stood out to me was Elizabeth James Perry, who you actually mentioned in your opening. The way that she examines not just art, but place as a woman who is Wampanoag is just so incisive and beautiful. Her jewelry is beautiful. She's also a museum curator. So her work is really incredible, and I just find it so, so inspiring.
How do you find these artists, and how do you choose these artists?
It's quite a process. What we do is we reach out to arts organizations and arts stakeholders here in Boston and beyond, and we ask them to submit names of folks that they feel kind of fit this criteria. And after they submit those names, our team kind of deliberates, and then we kind of move on to this year we had judges. So we had Catherine Morris, Rob Gibbs, and Leila Barmero, who helped us kind of decide on this final 25 who would be on the list. Some of the criteria that we had was that these artists had to be saying something new and different in a way that we haven't really seen before. And beyond that, they really had to have made like a new body of work, something exciting for us to view, for us to discuss within the past year and a half about.
I want to key on that new body of work. You mentioned this is the second time. The first list was back in 2019. We all know what happened in 2020.
We had a
pandemic. And in the early on, you in Arts and Culture, us here in Radio Boston, much of the station covered how hard artists were hit by this pandemic. And many artists had to survive and adapt. Amanda Shea, one of the featured artists, told us earlier today about how the pandemic led her to adapt her poetry. Here she is.
Before the pandemic, I was like, I wonder what my poems would look like in visual form. What if I could translate my poetry to film? And then COVID happened, and it gave me that opportunity to develop the treatment and reach out to videographers and work with other artists who also had downtime in COVID to be able to produce some of the greatest work that I believe that I've made in the last year.
So first, it's just incredible. It's heartening to hear someone say, I did my best work during this hard time. What were some of the other ways that you saw artists thrive, adapt, innovate, pivot during the pandemic?
I think we saw a lot of artists transform their art into a medium that would be more accessible, especially with technology. So we saw a lot of artists taking advantage of Instagram Live, going live, performing for folks who wanted to hear their music, their poetry. As Amanda said, we've seen also a lot of artists kind of focus on video, so more visual forms of their artwork, right? I think, you know, especially for a lot of maybe like artists who are more, maybe they do paintings or sculpture, I think that was definitely a little bit more difficult to pivot. But again, I mean, across the board, we've really seen artists push for their work to be seen and heard in so many different ways, really.
So I know that you have both talked about and thought a lot about the pressure that artists of color sometimes face to be topical, for lack of a better word, issue focused in their work.
Yes.
Pressure to make the work address, you know, social issues. Other times the voices of artists of color are left out of those same conversations about crucial social issues.
Yes.
How did the team think about that tension in putting this list together?
I think it's really hard for artists who come from marginalized communities because so often the artwork is representative of the things that they're dealing with in daily life in our society. And so it's often through that that we see art that's talking about these big issues like income inequality, racism, police brutality. But we did not want to make it a requirement for these artists to have to be saying something about their trauma, about their pain. We did not want that to be a requirement. We really believe that artists of color should have the space to explore their art as they are. They should not be required to have to say big things about big issues. I think their art and their experiences is enough.
So the spread on the website at WBUR.org on the arts and culture section is gorgeous.
Yes.
It's fantastic. How else can people connect with the Artery 25 and their work now?
You guys are free to follow us on Instagram at WBUR Artery on Twitter. But most of all, I really encourage everyone to visit the websites of these artists, follow them on their social media, support them, go to their shows, donate. All of these artists are doing so many amazing things, and literally every bit of support helps. Every bit of support helps.
All right. That is Arielle Gray, WBUR's Arts Engagement Editor. Hey, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Today is the first day of fall, and I have to confess, oh my God, I love fall. I just love fall. There is nothing quite like it, especially here in New England. Leaves changing, the temperature is crisp, but also warm, the humidity's dropped, all of which, it turns out, make for great hiking, either alone or with friends and family, especially, as Amanda Beland says, one of our producers, when you bring the right snacks. So we are going to talk about all things hiking, from location to snacks. Are you a hiker? Why do you love it? What are your favorite trails? Where do you go around here? Where do you go afar? And if you are not a hiker, do you want to be one? But maybe you don't know where to start. Ask your questions. Join this conversation. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. With us now, Sarah Holman. She is the creator of the blog She Hikes Mountains. And also with us, Becky Cushing Goop. She is the director of Mass Audubon West. Both are avid hikers. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Becky, also glad to have you.
Hello. Thanks for inviting me.
It's great to have you both. So, Becky, I am going to start with you because you have been hiking since you were a child. How'd you start? What drew you to it?
Well, I think it was more that my parents joined up with some other families and decided to take us as kids hiking. And, you know, it wasn't something we did every weekend, but I grew up in Saratoga Springs, New York, so the Adirondacks weren't far away. And we would hit some of the easier trails, usually something like 45 minutes to an hour to a quick, beautiful view. And so that's really how I got my first taste and started to love hiking.
So there are many things that I loved as a kid that just kind of didn't make it into my adulthood, but this did for you, Becky. So why? Mm-hmm. What stuck with you and made you want to keep going back time and again?
So I think what really stuck with me, and I didn't even realize until later adulthood, was I loved hiking because of how it made me feel. And physically and mentally, I just loved the feeling when I was out in the woods of not being plugged in and just breathing in fresh air and noticing views. And then just that sort of invigorating feel of hiking up some steep terrain. And I think the reward at the end, and whether that's a beautiful view or just a nice relaxing rest. And I also really, I think, recognize the mental health benefits of getting out into nature.
So I'm going to turn to you now, bring you in, Sarah, as well. First, I'm guessing, based on some of what you've written, that what Becky's saying resonates with you, but you're new. You started hiking last year during the pandemic, and you started writing about it on She Hikes Mountains. So how did you get started? What first drew you to hiking?
Well, I've always been someone who enjoyed the outdoors, and that is where I do most of my best creative thinking. And I just found that during those first 6 months of the pandemic, you know, we were all so worried all the time and just in this constant state of management, you know, and trying to juggle everything that was going on in our homes, with our families, with our work, keep everybody healthy. And so much was out of our control. And I just, I found that I was struggling to write anything other than like the grocery list, because my brain was just so in that mode of like, how are we going to get through this? And so about a year ago, August, I thought, I need something that takes me away and takes me out of this daily routine for long enough that I can truly disconnect from that worry and tap into some more creative, positive thought. And I very intentionally decided to hike alone because, frankly, I didn't want to have to worry about anyone else. You know, I was already so worried about all these people in my life, and I just wanted to go on my schedule. I had no idea how long it would take me to hike a mile. And, you know, I wanted to be able to stop and take pictures. And I just, it really, it only took one hike. And I just realized that, just like Becky said, it was just so empowering and invigorating and hard, but in the best possible way. And I knew immediately that it was something I wanted to do regularly, and I wanted to set goals around, and then that I wanted to write about and share with other people who might also want to, you know, find that kind of escape into this place where you could let go a little bit.
So listeners, where do you escape in the outdoors? Where are your favorite places to hike? And what does hiking mean to you? 1-800-423-8255. We've got Zane on the line in Brighton. Zane, go ahead.
Hey there. First of all, thanks for having me on the air. It's a pleasure to be here.
Welcome.
And, yeah, thank you. And yeah, I wanted to suggest to everybody who might live in the Boston area, Mount Monadnock State Park in New Hampshire, right on the border there. Maybe about an hour, 20-minute drive from Boston is a great place to go hiking. They have great facilities. It's very easy to find, easy to get to. The trail is so well marked. The trail is very well kept, so it's easy to follow that trail up. It is definitely a decently challenging hike, but the views at the top are absolutely 100% worth it.
Zane, thank you so much. So a couple things I want to ask the two of you out of Zane's call. First, Becky, Sarah, have either of you done the hike Zane's talking about?
I have not.
I have years ago, so my memory is a little bit fuzzy, but I think it's one of those that I did in my 20s.
All right, so Zane, adding value there. You're putting one back on the list for our two guests, which is great.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's the other thing. So, Sarah, you talked about the physically challenging nature of the hiking. Zane said it's a hard one. Mount Monadnock, you go up. It's a mountain. And I have often wanted to ask, what exactly counts as hiking? If one is walking in the woods and the ground is flat, does that count as hiking, or do you have to be going vertical? If I'm not breaking a sweat, do I get to say I hiked? So I'm glad you're both laughing, but I seriously want to know.
I call that a woods walk, which I also love. And a lot of times I hike a lot in the White Mountains in New Hampshire, and often the trails are this wonderful combination of exactly what you just said, where you're just kind of walking through the woods and, you know, taking it all in, and you're not breathing hard, and then slowly the terrain changes, and, you know, then you're walking up over some rocks, and then it's really, really steep. And so I think hiking can be anything where you're out in the woods and you're on a trail and you're pushing yourself, whether you're pushing yourself, you know, of course, that's different for everyone, whether it's a little bit or a lot. I call that hiking.
How about you, Becky? Woods walk versus hiking? Oh, I think we lost Becky. Becky's like, Becky disagreed with you so much, Sarah, that she's like, that's it, I'm out. All right, listen, I'm going to grab another call while we get Becky back. 1-800-423-8255 is the number. We have Allison on the line in Plymouth. Allison, go ahead.
Hello, Tiziana. Thank you for taking my call. We spoke earlier, and I mentioned that I'm actually a co-author of the Appalachian Mountain Club's book, Best Day Hikes Near Boston.
Yeah, go ahead. Tell us a little bit about your favorite hikes, Allison.
Well, actually, I'm very blessed because I actually speak to audiences throughout the state at libraries and outdoors groups and civic organizations, and I bring an illustrated presentation about hiking in Eastern Mass. It's called Hikes Through History, and it talks about the history of different spots to hike based on this Best Day Hikes book. But I get a lot of feedback from the audience, and they tell me about their favorite hikes. So it just multiplies the opportunities.
Terrific.
And it makes me realize we are so lucky in Massachusetts that so much land is preserved and open to the public for hiking, and there is such variety available as well.
That's fantastic. And Allison, before we let you go, beginner hiker, what's one location you would recommend?
Beginner hiker, there are some fabulous oceanfront hikes like World's End in Hingham, the Wampatuck State Park if you want to be in the woods. There are some wonderful Meadows hikes like Wachusett Meadows out in Princeton.
Wonderful.
That are not that challenging. Monadnock, I would say, wait until you have some good cardio involvement, because Monadnock is very challenging, and I'm afraid it will disappoint a lot of people.
All right, Allison, thank you so much. And Becky, I think I heard you. Do we have you back now?
I'm back.
Fabulous. So let me have you just pick up on this idea of what is a hike, Becky.
Yeah, so I use the word hike really loosely. And sometimes I don't use the word hike intentionally because I think it can be intimidating, especially for beginners, or actually in the case of my family, my kids, when they hear hike, they kind of think, oh no. So we use words like adventure. I think anything when you're getting outside, you know, maybe if you're going really slowly and you're doing something more like a mindfulness walk, I might not call it a hike, but otherwise flat ground counts in my book.
So, Sarah, I want to bring up another thing that's been on my mind as I've been listening to the two of you. You know, you hike alone. And I've been out on walks in the woods walks, which will be my word now that I've learned it from you, with my dogs. And I get out in the middle of the woods and I'm thinking, should I be alone out here? I mean, you are a woman who is hiking alone. Talk about that.
Right. I get that question a lot. And I think it's an interesting thing, people's fear. You know, I think so often our brains like to create the worst case scenario and kind of attach to it. And so I just recently, it's sort of the end of my year of hiking goals, I actually hiked 100-mile wilderness alone in Maine. And
wow.
I had some very real fear about doing that mostly around bears and bad people. And I really try to, when people ask me that, say, well, what exactly are you afraid of? Are you afraid of an animal or someone approaching you? Are you afraid of getting hurt? Because in most cases, there is an answer to that fear. You know, there are safety devices. There's GPS devices you can take if you're going on a long hike. You know, there's pepper spray, there's bear spray. There's a lot of ways that you can really have an actual tool to counteract that fear. And then I think a lot of it is just in our minds. And I found that the more I hiked and the more comfortable I became with my own ability to take care of myself in the woods, the less I felt those fears.
That sounds really empowering. So I'm going to go back to phones in a minute, 800-423-8255. But before I do, Becky, you're the director of Mass Audubon West. What does Mass Audubon tell people about safety, how to be safe?
Yeah, great question. So some of it depends on the time of year. A lot of it depends on knowing trail conditions, weather conditions, you know, for instance, knowing when a storm may be coming in or some weather might be expected, being prepared if things could get cold or rainy and making sure you have the right layers. Another thing this time of year that we start reminding folks is that the sun sets a lot earlier. And so to make sure you're giving yourself enough time to really get to wherever you want to go and get back before the sun sets, unless, of course, you're planning to hike during nighttime, in which case you have to bring different type of equipment. But I think, you know, Mass Audubon offers programs, so if people are unfamiliar, they could join a group and kind of gain some familiarity that way. You know, hearing about, thinking about fear, a lot of it is in the unfamiliar, so it's really just gaining some confidence in a skill set.
1-800-423-8255. Greg in Westwood wants to tell us about their favorite hike. Greg, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for having me. I heard this, just listened to the radio here in the car, and one of my favorite hikes that I just did, I've done it now twice in the last 2 years. It's called the Welch Dickey Trail. It's up in Thornton, New Hampshire.
Okay.
I would say it's probably moderate, but in terms of difficulty. But you know, my 9-year-old daughter was able to do it, but you know, she's probably healthier than I am. So, I think it's just such a great trail. It has everything. I heard you talking about, flat parts. There's some parts that aren't very challenging, but then there's others that are a little bit tough. So I recommend it to anybody who's interested in getting out of the great outdoors.
What's your favorite spot on the trail, Greg? Is there a tree or a view or a route that you walk over or anything that is kind of your favorite spot?
Yeah, the nice thing about it, and especially in New Hampshire, I think when you go hiking in New Hampshire, there's a lot of, you're walking through the woods, and there's sections that are, it's just bare granite, you know, so you're hiking over these sections where you feel like you're not in New Hampshire, you feel like you're somewhere else, like, you know, maybe out west somewhere doing hiking out there. So when you get to those spots, it's really great because you're in this environment that's a little bit different than what you expect, but then you look around and you see all the trees. You know, we did it in October last year, and you know, it was beautiful with the changing of the leaves and everything else. So
it sounds beautiful.
You know, you kind of get the best of both worlds, you know.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks for that recommendation, the Welch Dickey Trail. And we looked it up. United States Department of Agriculture says the trail varies through shady hardwood forests to open expansive views. And in the summer, wild blueberries can be picked as you approach the summit. So that sounds fantastic. Let's grab one more call here. We'll go back to our panelists after that. Amy's on the line in Lowell. Amy, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So first, I love Welch Dickey. I love Monadnock. This is a fun segment. Thank you.
Yay.
But I wanted to, I just wanted to say that I really enjoy hiking with my family. When I was a kid, my dad took my sister and I on all the 4,000 footers. So for the listeners out there that know the 4,000 footer club, that was something that I did with my dad. And then now with my kids, we're doing a lot of hiking. And with kids, we're really trying to teach them mindfulness. We're really trying to teach them how to get off screens, be present in the moment. And, hiking teaches all of that. During COVID, when it wasn't safe to visit outdoors, we'd go hiking and walking with friends, with grandparents. That's how we socialized. And so it's just, you know, if you're not into it now, if you didn't get into it in COVID, it's a must, I think. And I just really want to recommend to the listeners out there that New Hampshire's awesome, the beach is awesome, but all of our towns and communities have state forests and have preservation land. And last winter during COVID, 3 times a week, we would just head to Groton, to Westford, to Tingsboro, right in Lowell, Dracobull
awesome.
State Forest, just in our backyard, and really enjoyed interacting and observing nature 10 minutes, 15 minutes from my house.
That's fantastic.
So I just wanted to share that.
Amy, thank you. And thank you for reminding us of all the local places that we can go and hike. So, Sarah, I'm going to come back to you because Amy mentioned the 4,000 footer club. You
yes.
know about that club. Talk about that.
I do. Well, there's most of the 4,000 footers in New England are in New Hampshire. So there's 48 of them there. And those are mountains that are over 4,000 feet. So the tallest being Mount Washington at about 6,200. And then there are also, you can do the New England 67, which are 14 more peaks in Maine and 5 peaks in Vermont. And that was the goal I set for myself when I started hiking last year, was to do all 67 of those peaks in a year.
Amazing. And did you?
I did.
Wow.
Yes, I did.
So were you like sore all the time, or did it make you feel kind of like a superhero when you were done?
Yeah, in the beginning I was sore a lot, for sure. But then over this past summer I started hiking 2 to 3 days a week. So I'd go out to New Hampshire and I'd hike all day, I'd spend the night and I'd hike. And the 100-mile wilderness was kind of the thing I was working towards, because I knew that was going to be a lot of days in a row of a lot of hiking. And by the end, I just felt really, really great and really strong and really clear-headed.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And it's great to have a goal, you know, when there are so many mountains, right? It's really nice to just be like, all right, here's my list and here's where I'm going this week.
So, Becky, I'm going to come back to you here, because listening to the calls, listening to Sarah, makes me think there are probably lots of clubs and communities that get together to hike. Does Mass Audubon come across a lot of clubs, a lot of groups of people who get together for these experiences?
Yeah, so I'm based in the Berkshires, and we do have a lot of hiking, sort of informal hiking groups in the Berkshires, different some groups that have been around for decades and will go, you know, the same day a week, every single week through the whole year. So those definitely exist, and different nature centers, you know, Mass Audubon centers, but also other nature centers throughout the state are such a great resource for kind of finding those groups if you are looking to get involved but want to be doing it in a more social way.
So I want to get at least one more call in here. We've got Elisa on the line in West Roxbury. Elisa, go ahead with your question.
Hi, I was just wondering if you could recommend any accessible hikes.
All right, so Becky, Sarah, accessible hikes. Any locations that you could particularly recommend?
Well, I'll jump in there. So Mass Audubon does have accessible trails throughout the state, and not knowing exactly where you're located, your best bet would be to go on to massaudubon.org and check out locations of accessible trails.
So she's from West Roxbury, Becky, if that helps.
Okay. I don't know the one that's closest to you. I know that there's one, let's see, the one I was actually just looking at today was was in Princeton. But here at Pleasant Valley, where I'm based in Lenox, we have an accessible trail that's actually under repair right now, but just down the road, there's a beautiful one at Parsons Marsh that the Berkshire Natural Resource Council manages. But I think if you go on and check out all the accessible trails, there's a long list. So that, you know, talk about listing and the 4,000 peaks, another could be to visit all the accessible trails.
We will make sure to get that link onto our website at radioboston.org, too. And I understand that the two of you have sent us some of your favorite locations that we're also going to put on the site. So, Sarah, back to you. So you're fairly new to hiking. You're clearly all in on hiking.
Yes.
What's the next goal for you?
That's a great question. Honestly, right now, my goal is to keep hiking because with a specific goal of those 67 peaks, it really was a huge priority for me to finish. And what I don't want is to now say, okay, I've done that and stop hiking. So right now my plan is to go back to some of the peaks. I hiked in kind of junky weather and I didn't necessarily see a view. Fall is absolutely my favorite time to hike. It's just so beautiful. So I'm going to keep hiking every week. I'm going to get caught up on writing in my blog about all of my adventures because I haven't had a ton of time to do that because I've been hiking. And then we'll see. We'll see what happens from there.
All right. And Becky, lightning round, like two words, best hiking snack.
Well, we call it GORP, good old raisins and peanuts, but you know, you have to add in a bunch of M&Ms or something else to really make it fancy gore.
Nice. Perfect. All right. And that is Becky Cushing Goop. She is the director of Mass Audubon West. And Sarah Holman, the creator of the blog She Hikes Mountains. This was fun. Thank you so much. Sarah, good luck on your next hike.
Thank you so much.
And Becky, thanks
so
for all
much.
The tips. Take good care.
Absolutely. Thanks. You too.
All right, everyone, that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.